Firebird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today I am very pleased to have as my guest poet Neil McCarthy. How are you, Neil?
I'm doing great, Rich. Thanks a million.
Yeah, well, you know, thanks for being on the show, especially since I believe you're in the process of heading back to Ireland, yes?
Very much so. I have about 8 days left. I'm half human, half boxes right now.
Yeah, And then from that point on, once you're in Ireland, are you going to kind of be there for the
foreseeable future? People ask me this. I mean, they say you're moving back permanently, and I don't know what is permanent because I moved out here permanently 2 years ago, and now I'm moving back, so
right.
We'll see how it goes.
Right. The permanence of Neil McCarthy's impermanence. So Neil McCarthy studied English literature at the National University of Ireland in Galway and began writing poetry when he realized he was useless at playing the guitar. His first publications appeared in local magazines, and after influences and experiences in South America, Australia, Central Asia, and Scandinavia, his work has since regularly appeared in magazines and journals that include the New York Quarterly, Magma, Dreamcatcher, and Blue Dog. His poems have also been translated and published in Serbian, Hungarian, and Romanian. He has recited solo and performed with musicians at three consecutive Prague fringe festivals. He has also read at embassies, delivered lectures in foreign universities, and various living rooms from Los Angeles to New York, from Denver to Dublin, and all points in between and beyond. He is the author of three poetry chapbooks, and his debut album, which I might add is pretty darn amazing. The debut album, spoken word album, Live in the Laden, recorded live in Vienna, is now available from Label 08. Neil, one of the pieces that is on the CD that I'd actually like you to start the show with is a piece called North from Laguna Beach, and I thought it might be fitting, especially since you are in the process of leaving L.A., in which I believe that piece has something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about the decision, about the decision to move between two places, and I let the poem do the talking. North from Laguna Beach. It feels a lot longer in kilometers. The metric system making everything seem faster, further away, more expensive. And here we are again, making a mockery of geography, wishing our recent air miles could be ascribed to one company. Driving north from Laguna Beach, the Pacific struggles to sleep in the glare of the marauding metropolis around the corner. And it is Halicarnassus during a siege, abraded sketches of victors and the dead, the color of Antelope Valley in April, your Lithuanian skin where the sunscreen mist, or my cheeks ablaze with guilt the first time we kissed in Vienna. I was Orson Welles skulking in the shadows, and you, Alida Valli, our time measured like footsteps advancing on Gethsemane. And I've been drawing a windowsill of basil and rosemary and thyme, painting over the blue tack marks in the bedroom wall, and watching your stomach extend by its 9 monthly chapters. I've been nailing Hollywood signs to buildings we wish to claim, masquerading as a local on streets where angry men lash out at invisible foes and mothers cover their children's eyes as they are amused. But you are there every time, holding onto my arm as I hold onto yours, driving north from Laguna Beach. And outside our window, the contents page to a book is written with every metric mile, and the burning sky above Los Angeles just gets brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter.
That was wonderful. That was wonderful. You know, I really enjoyed hearing that piece on the CD. You know, it's funny, sometimes you listen to a CD and sometimes you think, I like them better live, or... Because I think I might have heard you do that piece live too. But you know, the beauty of that particular piece for me is it worked well live. It worked well on the CD. It also brings to mind a couple things that I want to talk to you about, because I want to make sure that I get the timeline correct. You've been here to LA before, and you've lived here before, correct?
I've been visiting on and off for the last 4 years, basically since I met my wife.
Okay.
We met in Vienna, and she moved over there, and then we had this like long-distance commute relationship for a year, then we got married, then she stayed in Vienna, then we moved back here. So that piece is more or less about the decision one of us has to make to move somewhere, you know?
Yeah. And what are your thoughts, because, you know, we're going to talk about this a little later on, but, I mean, you've traveled all over the world reading, performing. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on Los Angeles in regards to its literary scene compared to, Ireland or England or other places in Europe and beyond?
It's healthy, I will say that. It's also something which I'm sure if you were to ask me the same question in 3 months, I would have a lot more regret in my voice, because the geography of Los Angeles has beaten me in terms of I haven't been to as many literary events as I would have liked, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like in 2 years I've got a good handle on what happens here, and I think it's good, and there's a lot of diversity.
Do you? How about as far as acceptance? Would you feel that acceptance for your work is kind of the same worldwide, or do you feel that people in the United States or Los Angeles accept you in a certain way, or don't accept you in a certain way, perhaps that people in Europe might? Or
I've never thought about acceptance. I've been lucky to have felt welcomed and accepted, and I feel like my work goes down well. Most places I read, I'm not short of charm, but
right.
In a lot of the readings, I always find there's 3 lines of people after a show. There's those who are lining up to tell you that they have Irish relatives, like 4 generations back, who came here on a boat. There's another few people who want to ask me how I memorize my work, which I think, it's pretty simple. And then the shortest line is those who want to buy the merchandise, unfortunately. But,
Yes. I've seen that line at my readings.
Yeah.
It's sad to say, but I'm lucky that I have stumbled upon you and your work, but I actually didn't know of you or your work until one night a few weeks ago when we performed together at a whiskey poetry salon here in downtown L.A., actually not very far from the Rare Bird Lit office here. How did you get hooked up with those folks?
It was a case of simply going onto Facebook. I caved in under pressure. I wasn't on Facebook until about 2 years ago, and I caved in, and I went on the events thing that popped up, and the first thing I saw was a whiskey poetry salon, and I thought, yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
Those two things go together hand in hand, you know? So it's very rare to have, well, it's not rare, but it's unusual for me to go to a dry reading, so to say, like reading a library or a cafe. Back home, a lot of the readings take place in bars or places where people can have a drink and kind of let go of their inhibitions. And I thought this whiskey poetry salon was perfect, you know?
Right, right. Well, you seem to be, I mean, I got the impression that that was your sort of send-off reading before you leave these parts. And I got the impression that you've read there at least once or twice, or that you were a bit of a darling there.
I try to go as often as I can. It's only every 2 months, and
right.
They put on a great show.
They do, actually.
And you get to listen to everybody else who Johnny the Scot picks on randomly. So
yes,
it's
he
a nice
was
variety.
Great.
Yeah.
It was funny. I had actually kind of heard some horror stories about him before going into it, and I actually didn't know what to expect, and I found him to be extremely charming, and I just really loved him, and I thought he was actually really great at what he did, both
Fantastic.
The Scotch and his way of dealing with the audience.
Yeah, it's a good bit of banter between him and Kim and Caroline, and it works well. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so too. You know, when I saw you read, perform, there were a couple things that struck me right off the bat. First, like me, you pretty much memorize all your work. And you also have a very confident delivery, one that really draws the reader in. You know, part of that may be your wonderful brogue, you know, which I was really drawn to when I was listening to you. But I know that it's also got a lot to do with how you write and how you present your work, which gets me to my next thought. How did you first get involved with poetry, and how would you say your style has changed, your style and your writing has changed over the years?
I first got into poetry back in Galway City in Ireland. There's a very vibrant art scene there. Everybody you meet is a writer, everybody is a musician, everybody's an artist, a dancer, a performer of some sort, so it's a very nurturing environment. I think it was 2004, 2005, I met up with a local poet in Galway called Stephen Murray, who's been a massive influence on me over the years, and we just discovered it's an outlet to travel, it's an outlet to meet people and network and shake hands, and it brings the world to Galway, and, you know, Ireland can travel the world as well. So it's more of a it's a social thing for me. It's not about making millions, you know. But over the years, I would say that my poetry has changed in that I've visited so many open mics in so many different countries, been to so many readings. I'm kind of discovering now what I want to give the audience, because for me, they're the most important thing. They're the people who are making the effort to come, so I want to entertain them and let them leave the place feeling good about something.
Yeah. You know, there's a certain, and we're going to talk about, there's later on, there were some specific things I want to talk to you about your writing, but something you just said brought up a question, that being, over the years, as you've said, you've gone to open mics and different things. Would you feel that the way you present your work in regards to, there's a certain directness to it? It is very poetic, but there's also a certain directness to it. Would you feel that you've brought more of that? And there's also a real humanity to it. Would you feel that some of these things have changed over time in regards to wanting to connect more directly with the audience?
Absolutely, yeah. Like the inexperienced person who stands up to a mic might just be a bit nervous and want to read something specific. But the more you do it, the more you kind of look at the audience first. You get there a little bit early, you see who's sitting down, and you kind of get an idea of what would work best in that kind of environment. And so you tailor towards them, because the last thing you want is to be reading something very deep or something self-indulgent and it going over everybody's heads, you know, and it's just a waste of time for them and you, so.
Yeah.
You learn to be more comfortable, you know, with what you have.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, what works, what doesn't work, you know, there have been times, I must admit, where I've gone into a reading and sort of done that pre-show assessment kind of thing. I've scanned the audience. I've kind of gotten some preconceived notions of what I thought would work, certain pieces that I thought would work, certain pieces that I thought might not work.
Yeah.
And sometimes I've been right, but other times I've been very wrong. There were times where I thought a certain piece, you know, certain people in the audience would either be too offended by it or whatever. And sometimes those very people who I thought wouldn't appreciate it would be the ones who would come up to me after a show and say, I really love that piece. Mm-hmm. I mean, have you ever had situations like that where you do your assessing and you're just wrong one way or the other?
Yeah, often, very often.
Any particular stories?
Well, probably, I mean, you just mentioned that's a positive effect where somebody comes up and they tell you they love the piece. For me, the worst ones are where you know you've tried and tested a poem before and you look at the audience and think, great, this will make them laugh. You know, and you deliver the punchlines or the points of the poem where previous audiences have laughed and nothing. There's just a deathly silence, but you still have to kind of go on with the poem.
Yes.
And at the end, they clap because what they've heard is something really serious and dark. But in effect, you've just given them comedy, you know, but you're like, oh, God, okay.
Yeah.
Let's just get on with this and next.
You know, next, so, yeah. Exactly. Next.
Other things like Irish pieces or pieces that are particular to a place sometimes kind of fall flat on a lot of audiences, I find.
Yeah.
So you just have to kind of pick and choose.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. You mentioned memorization earlier, and, you know, like I said, I memorize a lot of my work for the simple fact that I don't like having a piece of paper in my hand when I'm standing in front of people, because I'd rather look at them and also use my hands to gesture or whatever. And for my memorization process, I simply, well, one, because I wrote the piece, I, you know, figure eventually I'm going to be able to memorize it because these are my own words, but I also just go through a process where I'll chunk the piece, you know, I'll just walk around and, you know, go through that, memorize it, go to the next section, whatever. What about for yourself? What's your process?
Exactly the same. I'd walk to work muttering to myself and getting looks off people thinking there's a schizo walking down the street. But
yeah.
If you've got the time, then go for it. I don't think, like you say, there's no difference to learning a poem other than learning a song is the same thing. If you sing it often enough, you remember the lyrics. But I don't know if you walk around the room, like I saw in the Whiskey Poetry Salon, if you mess up a couple of words, you keep going, nobody notices.
And yeah, yeah.
It's different every time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I mess up a certain line, flub a certain line, generally, you know, I'm the only one, for the most part, unless it's just a big gaffe, but I'm generally the only one who notices. So I'll just keep, you know, going ahead. I mean, I think the thing for me in those moments, and I think you can relate, is that what I try to do if there's a situation like that live, I try not to get too hung up on that moment and like beating myself up inside my head for flubbing that one line, because otherwise then it's just going to go downhill from there. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, just carry on.
Carry
a while.
On.
Yeah.
Yes.
Skip a line, nobody will know.
Yeah. You know, and looking up at your upcoming tour schedule, and this was something I mentioned earlier, you're going to be performing at some pretty amazing places, you know, back in Ireland, mm-hmm. Croatia, Prague, Budapest. With all your traveling, you know, I'd imagine that you've had some pretty amazing shows, but also some that were a bit dodgy for one reason or another. I mean, we kind of spoke about this just before, but are there any particular amazing shows or just kind of scary shows that you've had while traveling worldwide?
One scary one that just sticks out now you mention it, because I'm actually going back there. I'll be there in about 15 days from now. It was in a place called Cluj-Napoca in Romania, and it's in a province called Transylvania, which everyone knows for different reasons. But myself and this guy, Niall Connolly, a fantastic folk singer, Stephen Murray, who I mentioned earlier, and David Reinhardt, we arrived down there, and we were told we had this show, which we do, the voice and the verse, where there's two musicians and two poets. On stage, up we went, and there was a questions and answers before the show. And that went down fine, but we discovered that our crowd was pretty disgruntled, and we couldn't figure out why, but we kept saying we're delighted to be in Cluj-Napoca, but we didn't realize that this area was mainly Hungarian, and so they'd refer to the city as Kolosvar. Because it's kind of like an autonomous separatist mentality, and all they wanted to do was ask us about the IRA, and it just it was nothing like we had expected, you know. Yeah, great, you know, let's just get on with this song, you know. And so yeah, they were quite scary people, but at the end we all went for drinks and slapped each other's shoulders and things, but it really threw us, you know, that
right,
those questions all of a sudden.
Right. Now, you actually, and there's some music on your CD, and you also mentioned musicians just now. You know, there's a lot of sort of, how shall I say it, like voice and verse and music. And how well do you feel that, well, obviously you're going to have a strong affinity to this, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on the mix of poetry and music and things that you've done in your own work to help bring these two genres closer together?
I think it has a great relationship existing together on a stage, because you appeal to two different audiences. A lot of people would just go to a poetry gig or just go to a music gig, and if you mix the two, you've got double the audience. That's the kind of way I thought of it. You know, it might be very, maybe a bit too positive, but I mean, I love performing with musicians, and I think I could silence a crowd for them. You know, if they were opening up in a rowdy bar and I stand up and do a poem, a lot of people would tend to like stop chatting and listen.
Yeah.
And it kind of sets the tone for people to listen to a musician's lyrics. A lot of the time, lyrics go over people's heads because they're listening to the guitars, or the melodies. I think you can appreciate both genres.
Absolutely. When you travel to some of these places, Croatia, Prague, Budapest, do you ever have a translator, or are people pretty much able to understand you?
Generally, the people who come to our shows have a good level of English.
Uh-huh.
Now, they wouldn't understand everything. They'd get the gist of the poems. They get the gist of the songs. On a few occasions, I've had a translator. This time around in Romania, I have four readings. I'm going to have a translator there. I had a translator once in Budapest, and that was very strange, because I had no idea what he was saying. So he would look to me. We were going verse for verse in a poem.
Wow.
This guy Danny, but he would look at me every time he finished a stanza and nod, so I knew when to read my verse.
Right.
Because to me it was just Greek, but it wasn't.
Wow.
It was Hungarian.
It was Hungarian, yeah. Right, not to be confused with Greek. Why don't you go ahead and do another poem for us?
Sure. I'd like to do a new one if I can. Actually.
Oh, absolutely.
I only
that'd
finished
be great.
It a couple of hours
man,
ago.
What a treat for Poetescape and
there
everybody.
You go. Like, I'm leaving Hollywood, and I know when I get back to Ireland, people are going to ask me about, oh, do you see any celebrities? Who'd you see?
Right.
What was she like? What was he like? You know. And The first celebrity I ever saw was about 4 years ago in Gelson's supermarket.
On Beechwood?
Beechwood, yeah.
Yeah, Beechwood Canyon area, yeah.
It was Tom York, the singer from Radiohead.
Oh, wow.
Exactly, and I thought, I was a huge Radiohead fan back in the 90s, and I followed him around Gelson's, waiting for the moment. I was getting more and more nervous, you know, to go up and say something. And, aisle to aisle, down past the pizzas and the beers and stuff, eventually I summed up the courage and I went up to him and said, "You're Tom York," just as he was taking down 12 rolls of toilet paper.
Nice.
And he just, "Yes, I am.
Can you help me with this toilet paper?"
That was the end of that, you know.
Uh-huh.
A week ago I spotted somebody else, so I thought I'd write him this poem.
Oh, please.
So it's called Checking Out Eggs with Ron Perlman. What's the likelihood, I ask you, that Ron Perlman recognized me as I was ambling my way along the cheeses, past the cured meats, towards the open cooler of eggs and milk and even more cheeses? Do you think for a second he did a double take, hovered by the pyramid of mangoes and waited for me to turn around and suddenly reveal my strikingly familiar but can't quite put a name on face? Perhaps, had I been born a woman, with sultry locks, buoyant locks, and amazing everything else, waking each morning to the thrill of who might spot me in Gelson's, I'd be there, having sterile wiped the handle of my shopping cart, drifting seamlessly from the organic vegetables to the dairy. Ron Perlman would turn and glance, two ripe mangoes in his hands, the blast of cold air from the cooler just enough to make my nipples poke out of my sleeveless Fred Segal blouse. Ron Perlman would put his mangoes back on the pyramid and move closer to the free-range eggs. "Aren't you?" he would stutter, falling short of a name and regretting his impulsive decision. "Yes, I am," I would quickly reply, saving him the awkwardness of the situation. The conversation would, of course, begin with eggs and move on to work, with compliments thrown at random at my latest projects, his latest projects, and maybe a casting director or two we had in common but both secretly thought were complete dicks. The next day, he'd call round to my condo, and I'd meet and greet him with something vintage playing on my vintage record player, invite him in and wait for him to admire my Jonathan Adler this and Jonathan Adler that. I'd have pre-prepared a salad of goat's cheese and apricots, and he'd joke, "But no eggs." And we'd both laugh nervously at something that wasn't at all funny. Not beating about the bush and giving in to my own impulsiveness, I'd lean forward and touch his hand and say, "You recognized me yesterday, Ron. You did. And that made my day. You need to recognize people and remind them who they really are. You do, Ron, 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 you do." And he'd laugh nervously at a joke that wasn't at all funny as something vintage clicks to an awkward stop.
Nice.
Thanks. That's just a bit of fun.
Nice, nice. You know, do you ever get people coming up to you either, I don't know if here in L.A., but, you know, aside from Ron Perlman, but in Europe, anywhere where people will come up to you and say, you know, you're Neil McCarthy. I saw you read it, you know, X, Y, or Z, and I really enjoyed your reading.
Never. Short answer. The only time this ever happened to me was with English language students, because I make a living out of teaching English language. That's how I kind of fund my sojourns and adventures across the world. And it happened once on the metro in Milan.
Wow.
And once on a bridge in Regensburg, which is in Bavaria in Germany. But they're the only two occasions I felt like a celebrity. But
right,
yeah.
Right.
Otherwise, no.
Not yet. would you like that? Would you like to be a celebrity poet?
That's what that poem's about. You know, the highlight of the pinnacle of your career is being spotted in a supermarket.
Yeah.
Whatever about Oscars and BAFTAs and whatever else.
Right.
As soon as I'm taking down 12 rolls of toilet paper and someone comes up and asks me for an autograph, I will know I've made it.
You have made it.
Yeah.
Now, did you also see Ron Perlman in that Gelson's too?
He was in Gelson's, yeah. It was a weird, we were checking out eggs, and I looked to my right, there was Ron Perlman,
right.
And on my left was somebody from Arrested Development, the girl that plays Maybe, and I don't know her name.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, and I was sandwiched between the two of them thinking, yeah, this is weird, but...
Yeah, you know, there's something about, prior to Gelson's, that was a Mayfair market, and there's also another Mayfair in Silver Lake, and I don't know what it is about that market, because some years ago in Silver Lake at the old Mayfair, now Gelson's, I saw Beck there once. So
oh, yeah.
I don't know. His
house is up by the reservoir.
So yep.
Giant
yep.
thing, yeah.
Yeah. How would you say that, you know, we've talked about your traveling. How would you say that traveling has helped to change and shape both you and your work?
immensely. I just think it's one of the best educations I've ever had. My first trip, if I can remember, was the Czech Republic back in 2000 or 2001. I just graduated. But Europe has been really, really kind to me. Like you can get everywhere fairly quickly by train, and you just see such a variety. You see a lot of rich, you see a lot of poor, you see amazing architecture, you see slums, you see. It's such an education. It really is, going there and just feeling the age of the cities and the beauty of the countryside and the people who, for the most part, are very, very hospitable, you know, and you learn a lot from them just by talking, hanging out in cafes, hanging out in bars, and waking up on people's couches and jumping on another train. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Are you able to get much writing done on the road?
A lot, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. Put me on a train in a dining carriage going from Poland to wherever, and I will write 4 poems, you know. But if you put me in a library anywhere in the world, I'll do nothing, just look at people.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Do you, and this is just sort of a random question, do you tend to do more of your writing while drinking or just while sort of just stone cold sober? Or
I drink a lot of coffee.
Okay.
Yeah. Definitely, I just like being out.
Yeah.
And it has to be somewhere where I'm in the public arena where there's, you know, there's noise, there's background noise. I actually write more abroad because if I'm in, like we mentioned earlier, Hungary or Slovenia or something, I don't understand the local language, so I can't eavesdrop. Whereas if I'm here in a bar downtown and two people are breaking up in the corner and someone's having an argument on his cell phone, I will just listen to that. I will tune in and my writing will just go out the window. Whatever thought I had is gone. So
yeah.
It's great to write abroad because you have no distractions, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the reasons I ask about alcohol versus no alcohol or whatever is because a few of your pieces are sort of set within bars.
Yep.
One of my favorite poems that I'm hoping you can do right now is one of yours called No More Drink for Tom Thumb.
That was the first poem I ever wrote.
Wow.
I wrote that in an airport, Arlanda Airport, Stockholm, in 2001.
Well done.
I'd been scribbling up until then, but that was the first poem I kind of finished and thought, damn, that was all right.
Nice.
So it's been a crowd, well, I won't say crowd favorite, but it's a nice one to perform because it does encapsulate the Irish bar.
Yeah.
It was actually based on a true story. I worked in a bar in Galway as a student, and everybody had a nickname in this bar. And Tom Thumb was 6'8", about 280 pounds. But I can't tell you anything else because I want to go back and drink there in the summer.
Nice. Well, I'd love to hear it if you don't mind.
Sure. So no more drink for Tom Thumb. Isn't it fine for you? He said, raising the glass to his lips. At this stage, it was an almost magnetic force. You've the life. Haven't you the life? He said, as the glass approached the runway of the bar and made a perfect landing. A dozen more sets of eyes focused firmly on their drinks. They call it maternal instinct. And you have to watch them in case they run away. Because there's nothing worse than chasing your pint away out the door, down the street, in the cold, and the rain crashing like bricks outside. Before you know it, you're drinking nothing but water. But isn't it fine for us? The scholars and the prophets, the employed and the unemployed, out of the frying pan, into the fire, from the dole queue to the bar. But how erudite and well-read we are. Ulysses, the Bible, Irish Housewives Monthly, and the job section of the local. But maybe next week, maybe 14-1 tomorrow in the Grand National, lend me 10 and I'll pay you back tomorrow. And while you're standing there, land me another plane, will you, like a good man? One for the ditch, I suppose, a smart prick says as his elbows slip, tipping his glass and spilling his blood all over the runway. No more drink for Tom Thumb, came the voice from the control tower. They had to carry him out to the taxi. Messy? Oh, he doesn't know when to stop, but he'll know all right in the morning. And so will we. But isn't it fine for us? Will you have one more? Jesus, no, I must go. It's raining outside. Sure, one more so, but call this the last one. And 14-1, did you say? Lend me 10 as well, and land me another plane there, will you, like a good man? But make this the last one, for you, for me, for the liver and its misery. Sing us a song, and we'll all leave together, and crash outside the door like bricks. Then we'll all say a prayer, that the rain might show some mercy.
That was beautiful. You know, the sentiment of this piece, as with some of the other pieces you have set in bars, remind me of an old Paul Westerberg replacement song called Here Comes a Regular, where Paul was talking about how, you know, there's a bar and everyone knows everyone and everyone's business. And as you said, you know, people have nicknames, you know their stories. And when I was hearing this piece, No More Drink for Tom Thumb, I was getting that certain ache in my heart that I got when I first heard the replacement song. I'm curious, what would you say it is about bars in particular? Why do they evoke such strong feelings in you, and why do you feel compelled to study humanity in that particular setting?
I think if you work as a barman or you frequent bars, you automatically qualify as an anthropologist.
Right.
You can skip the degrees. Forget it. Because like the poem No More Drink for Tom Thumb, I'm likening a bar to an airport. Because an airport, you see people at departures lounge very sad. See people at the arrivals who are very happy. You see people in transit who are just out of it, confused, almost drunk, you know, depending on the price. And a bar for me is exactly the same. There's life. There's emotion. A bar in Ireland is your living room. It's a source of heat. It's a source of music. It's a source of conversation. It's where your friends, it's your meeting point. You get food there. You get drink, obviously. So put all those things together and you get every aspect of life that you want to see, depending on the bar.
Right. You know, another poem of yours that I really enjoy, Parliament Bridge.
Hi.
And I was wondering if you could maybe talk a little about it, the inspiration, and if you feel so moved, actually, do
sure.
That piece.
Yeah, Parliament Bridge, again, it's one of these bars, I have to kind of be careful what I say, because it's one of my favorite bars in Cork City, in the south of Ireland. Now, No More Drink for Tom Thumb is set in the west of Ireland, but Cork City in the south, if you're ever there, there is a bridge called Parliament Bridge, and over the bridge you have a plethora of drinking establishments.
Right.
One particular night I was killing time because I'd taken a bus down from Galway and my connection down to southwest Cork, which is another hour and a half south, wasn't for another couple of hours, so I thought I'd go for a couple of scoops, as we say back in Ireland, a couple of scoops of Beamish.
Right.
Because they're really cheap. And if you're any way different in these bars, kind of people look at you. No disrespect, Rich, but if you walked in there tonight dressed like this...
Right.
They'd take mighty pity on you and concern. And this is what happened to me, because I was in a pair of flip-flops and, you know, sleeveless T-shirt, and they thought I was either depressed or gay or
Right. Something
must be wrong with you. You know what I mean? So that's what that poem is about.
Nice. Well, I'd love to hear it again.
Sure. Parliament Bridge. But at least you're Irish, he said, eyes beamish black. And a face that reminded me of Andy Townsend for no other reason than Andy Townsend's face was the first face that came into my head as I tried my best to avoid eye contact. City's full of foreigners now, he said, wiping 30 years of stout from his upper lip. They wouldn't be long adding up at 2.85 a pint, and that for sure was neither his first nor his last tonight. I wanted to tell him, though, that I was English. A tan, he might say. That my flesh and blood was as alien to Cork as Warsaw to Brooklyn. But then, all of a sudden, he was more concerned with me throwing myself off of Parliament Bridge. Have you enough money? I had. And then he went on to talk about wealth and the sacrament of land, and suddenly I was unsure as to whether his face now reminded me of Andy Townsend or Genghis Khan. You're too depressed, he said. You're too depressed, and you're wearing sandals. But sure wasn't the weather mighty altogether, as the full moon keeled over in the sky, laughing off any advance dawn might be planning. Still, plenty of time for me to throw myself off of Parliament Bridge, only to end up in a John Spillane folk song a few years from now, or a Billy Ramsell poem, where the hero is not me, but he who hauls my bloated corpse from the water on Union Quay. And if I died here tonight, then how bad? You could bury me beneath these creaking old floorboards, where I could lie and listen to men like him craft cavalries from nights spent on park benches in London, from all the bricks that have bent his back, from the misfits of the Irish economy who would look at a man sideways for talking to me, as I stopped to admire the flicker of the South Channel from the wall of Parliament Bridge.
Wonderful. You know, as you intimated in the poem, and I want to make sure I have my timeline correct, you were born in England, but then you eventually moved to Ireland, right?
I swam.
You swam.
Well done. I had enough of Thatcher by the age of 9 months.
Swam over in those flip-flops. And
that's it?
Yeah. So, but okay, so you were born in England, moved to Ireland, you've spent time in Vienna, Los Angeles, so many other places, you've done so much traveling. At this point, where would you consider home? Is it Ireland? Is it somewhere else? Or
I don't know. That's the honest question. I'm married to an LA woman. I have a great affinity with the west coast of Ireland, even though my family's in Cork in the south. We'll see. I brought out a chapbook about 5 years ago called Seven Cities, and each of the seven poems represented a city, and each poem had a quote, and one of my favorite quotes in the chapbook was by T.S. Eliot, and he wrote in a poem called Little Gidding, "The end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time."
Wow.
And I loved it.
That's beautiful.
Because I believe in it, you know. I'm going back to Galway next week and hopefully have a nice little cottage or something with a bit of land, but after 2 years we might decide to go somewhere else, so we'll see. Yeah. I don't know what is permanence, as we said.
Well, with all this moving around, what are things that you do to ground yourself, to keep yourself kind of rooted in some sort of sensibility, even if it's just to be rooted in yourself?
I don't know, really. I mean, I like to have a sense of place. And it's important no matter what the city, if it's LA or Vienna, Melbourne, I've lived there. I like to be able to go out, and for me, one of the great things is walking into a cafe or a bar and people knowing what I want. You know, it's even if I go into Starbucks and people say, Doppio, I feel great.
Right.
I'm known. I'm recognized. You know, I'm not Ron Perlman, but people recognize me.
That's right.
And that it makes you feel like you're welcome somewhere, you know, and for me that's important, so...
So of the poetry scenes that you've been able to check out while here in L.A. or any other places you've been able to check out while sort of touring in the States, what would you say are some of the similarities and differences between, let's say, United States poetry and art scene versus what's going on in Europe?
Language?
Yeah. Yes.
I've been to a lot of German slams, and they are terrifying. But I think what the United States art scene has in terms of poetry is you've got very supportive audiences. You've got a lot of diversity between page poets, established poets, spoken word, hip-hop, slam. Not so much of that, I'll say, in England and Ireland, but then that's a dangerous thing to say. I haven't been there since 2008 permanently.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you've got a lot more variety going on here. You've got the population, you've got the larger cities, and so therefore even for musicians you can play six nights a week to different audiences, and in England and Ireland you can't do that.
Oh wow.
So it's everything seems to be fresh here. You can do the same poem for 6 months to different people, you know, and it's
right
that won't fly in Ireland.
Why is that? They just why is that?
It's, you know, you're talking about smaller population. There's 3 million people in the whole of Ireland,
right,
which is like Hollywood.
Sure.
So if you were to do a reading, we'll say, in Cork City or Limerick or Galway, do it once. That's you done for 8-9 months or a year.
Right.
Because people aren't, you know, or you're going to come back with a different set every time. And
right.
I think that's the difference here. You can get away with repeating a lot here.
Got it.
Maybe that's a good thing about the smaller countries. You have to keep writing, you know.
But So... As I mentioned earlier in the show, and also a few of the pieces you've done for us have been off your CD, Live in Leiden. I was hoping you could talk about the CD, how it came about.
Absolutely, yeah. There's one of my favorite venues in the world talking about places to do poetry is actually in Vienna. And it's a place called Verein 08, or Verein 08. And it's run by a fantastic guy called Dominik Nostitz and his family, brothers and sisters, and dog. And it's just like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a salon, you know. But you go there every, it's only on a Thursday night. You go there on a Thursday, you get a cheap beer, you sit down in this mishmash furniture, and you watch a musician, a science night, any kind of presentation, a poet. And they have this rule after 10 o'clock that you can't clap because there's an old woman living upstairs. So you you got to wave your hands in the air and say, "Woo."
That's great. I think you mentioned that on the CD or
I might have done, yeah. Or
yeah.
You might notice that nobody claps after track six. that's the reason. A lot of people just think, wow, that crowd really died a death. But it's, they're not allowed to clap. They just have
that's
to go, "Woo."
That's funny.
And it's surreal. I mean, if you're a musician and you just play this amazing song and you turn around, "Thank you very much." And everyone just waves their hands and goes, there's a silence, but everyone's waving at you.
For those of you audience members, you cannot hear it, but Neil is now waving his hands in the air.
I just did it there.
That was loud applause and hand waving.
That was Viennese loud applause. But anyway, so I used to go there all the time, and like Dominic christened me the Poet Laureate of the Ladin, and we decided to do a CD.
Nice.
That's his label 08, and he's doing good things with it and bringing out other CDs, and so that's why we wanted to do that, because I was leaving Vienna, so
yeah.
So he's a great guy. So I can't wait to go back there in a couple of weeks and do another show.
Now, the opening of the CD, and at first I'm still not really sure. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm still not sure whether it was a joke or if it was an earnestness of this guy. There's a guy who I gather is like the MC or something, and I don't know if he keeps saying cool A or is cool A or he kept.
Cooper. Yeah, cool. It's actually me.
Oh, that's you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
It's me doing an impression of Dominic, and he'll kill me for this, but Dominic is amazing because he will introduce a night in about four languages. He'll do it in German, he'll do it in French, he'll do it in Italian, he'll do it in English. But there must be something going on where he just, there will be a pause between things like, "So, we got Rich Ferguson and we voice sing tonight? Yeah. Cool. It's from L.A. Yeah." And so the introductions kind of go on for about 25 minutes, and it's this legendary introduction. So you can't actually see it on the CD, but Dominic was actually standing there miming while I was standing behind him doing his voice. It was funny at the time, but
it's funny on the CD.
I think people might skip that track, but no, it's you know.
You know, another thing that I notice about your work is that you have this really succinct and beautiful way of distilling the poetry from everyday life, and your poems then gather this real flesh and heartbeat. And I'm curious how you went about developing that ability. Was it something you were conscious of? Did it come naturally?
It was something I was definitely conscious of. I'm not critical as much as I should be to my poetry or other people's poetry. But I consider everything a form of poetry, and this might sound weird, if there's poetry in it. I think it was Ezra Pound who once said, like, you know, write what you want to, free verse, but don't forget about poetry. And a lot of people write stuff and they perform it and you listen to it and you think, oh, that's okay, but it's not poetry, it's your diary or it's an anecdote or something. So you've got to come back to the words, and I try my best to work with words, to think of new ways of describing the same idea, because face it, as musicians, as artists, as songwriters, as poets, we're writing about the same things, but just in a different way. I'm just conscious of it. You know?
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier you spent a bit of time in Vienna. It's also the place where I believe you met your bride. I was wondering if you could tell that story, because I've heard you say it before. It's a really sweet
story.
She
tells it way better than I do.
well, she's not
got,
here.
She's kind of got the female perspective, the romantic. The
kind of that Rashomon effect where one person has one story and you have another story, and it's just like...
Mine is the abbreviated... treated her like a gentleman for four nights, then I got her drunk on the fifth night and kissed her, and that was that kind of thing. But no, it's not like that. Like we actually met in one of these beautiful Viennese cafes. First words I said to her, "Is der Platz frei? Is this free?" And she said, "Sorry, I don't speak German." But
right.
Yes. And I was babysitting my friend's child at the time. Just purely coincidental, I wasn't not using the baby as a female magnet.
Right.
So I just turned to the baby and I said, not mine.
Right.
And that was it. Yeah.
Nice.
So it helped having the baby and the stroller with me. But
nice.
That's how we met.
You know, while I was sort of going through your website, I was pleasantly surprised to see that you review poets on your website, review their work, and I noticed Brendan Constantine and some other American poets, and then that sort of brought to mind this idea of, first of all, I thought it was really cool that you were doing that, and then next, how familiar would you say that Americans are with European poets and vice versa, and also, do you feel that there's any sort of rivalry or snobbery between the two?
I haven't found any rivalry or snobbery, but what I have found is there's a lot of blanks, because like Americans or American audiences, when we talk about Irish poetry, they want to ask me about Seamus Heaney, they want to ask me about Austin Clarke and Patrick Kavanagh and Evan Boland. But I want to tell them about Stephen Murray and Billy Ramsell and Elaine Feeney and, you know, poets that probably don't get much of a look in here. Maybe it's the size of the publisher or it's a small market, you know. Similarly, when I go back to Ireland, people are going to say, so what about the American scene? Tell me about Jane Hirschfield, Nicky Finney, Billy Collins. But I want to tell them about Brendan Constantine. I want to tell them about Beverly Collins, Rich Ferguson, Jessica Wilson, Mel Weisbird. You know, there's potential for a great crossover, but I don't know how to make that happen. And if I can just contribute to that by blogging about it, what I want to do is put an Irish or an English poet along with an American poet on my blog. There's always two books together.
Nice.
So that's what I'm trying to do, just to, you know, social media, you're going to tag both of them.
Sure.
Who are going to meet, you know, online at some point. So.
Sure.
That's the plan.
Well, good for you for helping to bridge that gap. We need more of that, because it does seem to be this, as you said, this sort of gap.
There is, yeah.
Yeah. We're getting close to the end of our time, but I was hoping you could close the show out perhaps with another poem.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd be delighted. Any requests? Or?
Well, I know we were talking about Vienna. I know you have a Vienna poem, but if you have something else you'd rather do.
I'll give you an exclusive, Rich.
Let's go for another exclusive poet.
I'm not very often on radio.
Another Poeticscape exclusive, okay.
I've given you Ron Perlman exclusive. I'm going to stay with the theme of L.A. Like, I'm not going to have negative poems about L.A. In retrospect, good ones always come back, you know.
Nice.
I always write after the experience has happened. However, this is a poem called How to Kill a Pig. I expected them to tell me that my bacon had come from a happy pig, one that had had a full life, was corn-fed and had free range, did yoga in the mornings, played the cello, spoke Latin, and learned to salsa dance while visiting relatives in Cuba. I thought maybe there would have been a photo album to accompany the sacrifice, documenting its first birthday, first snow, first black belt, and first of everything else, here an oink, there an oink. In far corners, I dubbed the mouths of others, their new voices out-battling the clattering gunnery of plates slamming down organic everythings. I gifted one woman berating her phone the French language to make her all the more endurable. Sweet as raw cane sugar to my fair trade coffee, I had the young couple across from me nattering fondly from their deathbeds, their soon-to-be-left world better off now than it was when they were fools. The child in the high chair was at it too, breaking into l'enfant et les sortilages, when faced with a spoonload of non-GMO beige matter. I used a sortilage of my own in stripping the walls clean and emblazoning the newspaper headlines all over them to see if anyone would notice, remark, question that one glaring absence, as truth was let out the back, strung up by his legs, throat slit, left to be hung there until the last drop of blood spattered into the bucket.
Well done, well done. And on that note, with me today has been international poet, rather than just poet, international poet Neil McCarthy. Neil, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much, Rich.
Yeah, and what's the best way for people to find out about you online?
Just Google Neil McCarthy poetry. You'll find a website. You'll find something.
Well done. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show's sponsor. For all your writerly needs, please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, Spotify, and Twitter. Speaking of which, you can find me online at wevoicesing.com. YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week. Very excited about this show when my guest will be L.A. writer Antonia Crane. We'll be talking about her latest memoir, Spent. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.